Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff, and this is edition 273. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be speaking to an important Indigenous photographer, Martin Loft. Martin has long done a multitude of different artistic practices, from photography, but also print work. Martin has worked in the cultural center of Ganasatagi, giving artistic courses to Indigenous community members, but also has exhibited photographs, both focused on Indigenous experiences locally and globally. Martin is also a street photographer and does a lot of documentation around frontline street experiences, as Martin has also worked at community centers connected to the network of Native Friendship Centers. In general, Martin's work is very important, really inspiring Indigenous photographer working today. And so I wanted to share a spotlight on his recent projects. And so here is our conversation.
I'm sitting with Martin Loft, Indigenous photographer who has spoken on this program before and is always up to all sorts of awesome activities. I got a list before this conversation of everything you're working on, and it's looking great. And so I'd love to get into some of these details, but first, I think it might be interesting to sort of start off. We're in spring, so that's cool. A lot of spring sort of like themes are around rebirth and rejuvenation and sort of the cycles around that. In some ways, these last few years have seen rejuvenation and resurgence of Indigenous cultural expression. But also there's huge challenges that remain, both around support for Indigenous artists, but also autonomous Indigenous arts institutions. I know you always have a lot to share about those types of ideas. So maybe we could just first start by a brief introduction and then sort of your sense of where things are at around those broad points.
Yeah, all great. Well, thanks for having me on there, Stefan. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I know you're a great supporter of Indigenous issues and arts and culture and all the things that are connected to it. My name again is Martin Aguirre-Noru Loft. I'm born and raised Kahnawake. I worked at our cultural center in the community for 30 years involved. I had my hand in a number of little baskets, you know, things going on. And one of them, when you walked in, I was listening to our All Ganyakeha radio show, and I used to be intimately involved in the production of that show and our annual all-day events and so on that we used to have in that program. It's always good. I'm a student of the language. I studied the language. I did the immersion, and unfortunately, I'm not a fluent speaker, but I listen, and like learning any language, you know, it's kind of like I can pick up maybe 25 to 30% of the conversation, mm-hmm. and in between, I can kind of like decipher what's being said. So it's always very interesting, but I can passively understand more than I can speak. Spring is a very important time for our people. Of course, Mother Earth, you know, continues to do her cycle, and you know, it's spring, and the trees are the sap is running. Wata is our name for the tree, and a tree is what they say is the leader of the trees. We have we give thanks to all creation, from the tiniest insects to the stars and the cosmos, and our grandmother, the moon, our father, our brother, the sun. But in between, we have to give thanks to all those things, the grasses, the seeds, and for sure, maple is coming up. And I know that maple in Quebec, you hear about the Cabanasuk and you hear about all these things, and you rarely hear about the origins of some of these things. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you do, but mm-hmm. I'm saying that most people, I'm sure, who go to these things are oblivious that, you know, come springtime, come the running of the sap, you know, the native people in this part of the Northeast North America are giving thanks and greetings and burning tobacco at sunrise and thanking the trees for all of the things that they give us, for our housing, for our furniture, for warmth, and for the sap that runs and the sugar that is made afterwards. It's very important. We are people who live traditionally by the cycles of the environment, and the cycle of ceremonies is intimately involved with nature and with the natural world. Global warming and issues to do with that, you know, are starting to change a little bit. You know, people are beginning to look at collecting seeds, heirloom seeds, seeds that are important to our culture. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, these things are changing, so things have to be adjusted. In fact, I think even some ceremonies as well, you know, I mean, it's basically based on the moon, but, you know, there are things that that have to happen based on the environment and the seeds that are germinating and coming up and so on. Very, very important stuff. And, you know, we always have to stop and give thanks and greetings to these things. In the arts field, you know, as I've told you in the past, and I've been on this show and we've talked in the past about, you know, many of the projects that are happening in Montreal, at the Dayonjo Jaga here. It is really heartwarming to know that, you know, at one time, you know, we could expect, you know, an Indigenous art show to happen once every 5-7 years. And it was used to be in cycles of, like, there's an interest, you know, like something happened in society, something, you know, was going on that there was an interest, whether it was a trend or it came into fashion or whatever. But what's interesting is, and I've spoken to other artists about it, Indigenous artists, was like, you know, he always got the feeling that it was going to be contemporary, you know, that the other foot is going to drop and we won't be in style anymore. We won't be called to be, you know, participating in these things. But what I've noticed, I would say in the last 10 years, maybe a little even longer, in Montreal anyhow, I think it really is beginning to change. You know, there are signs that, you know, that it's a permanent thing. You know, that Indigenous artists and opportunities in the arts are blossoming, and, you know, it's a very encouraging sight. I might have told you this story. In 85, we had a big exhibition at the University of Quebec downtown, and, you know, at that time we thought it was going to be ushering in this great period of interest and, you know, opportunities and art exhibitions and curators, you know, looking for, you know, an authentic voice, an authentic visual style, you know, that kind of like caught on. And unfortunately, those things kind of like slipped away on us. And people, I would say, in my generation coming up, you know, often went to other places, you know, found opportunities in Ontario, in Toronto, in the U.S. and elsewhere, and developed their careers. But like I said, here in Montreal, you know, it's beginning to change. One of the fantastic things that I've kind of had a hand in, I've kind of been involved with, is with the Daphne Art Gallery. That is a beautiful place down on Cosgrain Street, where many of the emerging and established, you know, Montreal creative community is, you know, that are creating great work and, you know, sharing ideas and so on. They've been in open, I think, at least for 3 years, and they are doing some great programming. You know, they've got some great artists coming in from the rest of Canada, from local people, and they are always open to collaborations and those things. And I'm very pleased that they included me last year in the Nuit Blanche. We did a great printmaking event, and we had a couple hundred people come through. Wow. People were really pleased. And this year, they are partnering with the Momenta Visual Arts Festival. It's visual arts, but I know they have a strong component of what they call lens-based art, so a.k.a. photography, but not exclusively photography. I know that, you know, there's some very, very good people in there working with that organization, and I've been, like I said, recruited to be part of part of that. And we're looking at Aaron Rice is going to be curating it, and we're hoping that my good friend Gisiwi Guy, if you're out there, hopefully you're going to agree to be involved and to help do some text. I always like his take on my work. He's written about some of my work in the past. I'm always very surprised sometimes, but also I even learn stuff about myself when someone writes about your work. You know, it's like I intended for people to get that idea, but sometimes you wonder if it translates. And with Guy, I think he's very sensitive to photography, to visual arts in particular, and he's been a great supporter. You know, some of the museums that are doing things too as well. McCord Museum's got, you know, great one that. Curator that is there now, Jonathan Laney, and he's doing some wonderful work. He did a great exhibition on wampum. I don't know if you got to see the wampum exhibition he did last fall. Wonderful. He basically went around the world and collected and had borrowed wampum belts that were used in diplomacy over, wow, you know, the last 400 or 500 years, wow, in the Northeast. And brought them back to North America for the first time in many, many years. Really quite beautiful and very kind of educational, but cultural, symbolic, political. You know, it just, because they are basically our documents, mm-hmm, that had been used historically over, you know, 1,000 years. People say that indigenous people don't have a writing system. Well, we have wampum belts, mm-hmm, that are precise declarations of what happened, and the beauty of it, like the ancient Greeks, you know, the oral, verbal transmission of knowledge was also very important. You know, that it breathed life into the words, and people's jobs and communities were to learn what, mm-hmm, these treaties had to say, learn what these declarations had to say, and to memorize them and to pass them on through the ages. And we have many examples of that, like the Turo Wampum, the Gaswanta, the Five Nations Confederacy Belt, on and on and on, that these things have been able to do.
Wow. So, I mean, there's a lot for people to look into there, luckily. And so I really would encourage people to look up these various strands. I want to just pick up on a few of them, just to make sure to dig a little bit on some of those points. You mentioned at the beginning K103, which has this indigenous language broadcast on Wednesdays. An awesome station. Maybe this is an opening to talk about indigenous language.
Sure.
Just briefly, I think that some people listening won't be aware of the major effort, not just at the radio station, but in many other contexts, I'm sure that you've been connected to, around language revitalization.
Yeah, absolutely. Ganawagi, I mean, surprisingly, you know, we are in the shadow of one of Canada's major metropolises, you know, like 10 miles out of downtown Montreal, and our language has been able to be preserved, you know, and it would say that it's in decline, but I would say that if any language in this area has a fighting chance, it would be our language. We started in our community close to 40 years ago, an immersion program for children, and many of those children have grown up and had children, and they are passing on the language.
Wow.
And we also have an adult immersion program as well that takes in I believe about 30 students a year. It's not a major number, but I mean 30 students who are dedicated to learning the language, and it's a two-year commitment. If you, wow, sign up, you register and you go in and they select you, you know, you have to be prepared to drop everything for 2 years, and that's usually, it's young adults. Some of them like CJEP age, and some of them older. When I did it for a year, and it was, I went in, I would say in my 40s. Yeah, I was in my 40s. Had I been younger, I suppose maybe I would have had a better chance to become fluent. My daughter, who is 29, she just entered the program. She's finishing up her first year, and she's making amazing progress. And you know, I'm really thrilled. And hopefully, you know, in the next year, and then in the coming years, you know, there will be even more advances. Mm-hmm. It's really quite amazing. The communities founded the radio station. One of the main things was to revitalize the language, to normalize Indigenous languages, our language, on the radio, you know. And I remember I worked at our cultural center for 30 years. When I first started, I worked with many elderly people who told me about when they first heard our language on the radio. Some of them cried. You know, some of them said, like, I never would have in a million years would have imagined that we would be speaking, we would be able to be telling stories in our language over the year. So, you know, you have to really take your head off to the people who are doing that. Now, you know, the show is on once a week. When I was there, we did once a week, but we also used to, and they still do, three times a year. They do like a half day of programming, and it's really like a telethon, a radiothon. You have people come in, you have elderly people, you have children, you have teachers, you have people who are just, you know, just happen to be in the area, and there's food involved and storytelling, and it's all centered around our language.
Hmm. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. There's also, I mean, if we want to just build on this term language, I think that it seems that in a lot of your photography, you're also developing this visual language and also documenting the communities, the many different Indigenous communities that are present in this city and around. And so I know that you also do photo workshops and printmaking workshops. But yeah, I mean, just around like the importance of this sort of work to develop a visual language from your vantage point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, I mean, you think about any metropolitan area and you see, you know, all of the communities. Well, Indigenous people were here before all of this happened, you know, our languages, our cultures, the paths that we walked upon, the rivers that we fished in and swam in, yeah. You know, and I would say, you know, the through the evolution of the growth of the city, all of these things sometimes kind of like faded away, you know, like people didn't see these things, didn't hear about people doing things. But in a sense, we've always been here. People yeah. in Ganawake have always come yeah. to Montreal. We've always traded, you know. We have some of the early, you know, the founding of Montreal and markets that were taking place in old Montreal around the Bon Secours Market, where the museum of what is it called, the Punta Caliera Museum, that there used to be markets, and there were Indians there. There were people from Ganawage, from the north, coming here trading for furs, trading vegetables, buying things. There's an epic program that we found. It's actually in our library, and it's in old Montreal in the 1870s, 1880s, and it's all of the stores in old Montreal that catered to Mohawks, and they had it in our language, which is like holy wow. mackerel. They had you know, pages and pages of shoemakers and you know, tool makers and everything like this. So we've always been here. We're always going to be here. One of the projects that I'm most excited about, and I'm excited a whole bunch of projects, but the annual Orange Shirt Day, or Truth and Reconciliation Day, I've been documenting that event that has occurred in Montreal, at least the rallies, the manifestations that have occurred over the years. So this year will be my fourth year, and I plan to continue to document it as long as I have legs and camera to film, or digital SD cards to fill and everything. So I've been documenting that, and I'm really pleased that if anybody's familiar with what's called street and documentary, like like heavy metal. There's like 50, 100 branches of the family, you know, like what is documentary and what is, you know, cinema verite and, you know, all this kind of, or interviews. Or so with photography, there are many, many kind of like branches of the family. But the branch that I kind of identify with and I really enjoy is what's called street photography. So it's basically candid photography in the streets for the most part. And you just kind of like, you go with the flow, you go with the river that is going, and along that journey, you know, you take pictures, you try to find moments that resonate with you and kind of speak to the issue. And whenever I go to these events, you know, I go and I think about, you know, my dad who went to residential school. I think about my grandparents that went to residential school. I think about the pain and the suffering, and we're moving down, you know, all of these, the corridors, the canyons of Montreal, of, you know, steel and concrete and asphalt and so on. And it's kind of like most people are walking, and myself, you know, walking with that heavy feeling, but also feeling of that, you know, that we survived, that you know, there are many attempts along the road, you know, to make us disappear, to make our languages disappear, to do all these things, but in ways and in methods we resisted, and we're still resisting, we're still speaking out loud, you know, against the government, against, you know, the churches, you know, and informing, you know, the people that, you know, these issues exist, that we're still here. And I'm really pleased that I was able, and I've been able to document them, and I've gotten hundreds of photographs that I enjoy. And the exhibition that's opening at the McCord on the 18th, April 18th, is called Pounding the Pavement, which that is a common expression that street photographers, people go out into the world and try to make art out of the environment that we live in, use. And I'm really pleased that the type of work that I'm going to be exhibiting in this is the work that's from these events. So I mean, it is meaningful to me, and I'm really pleased that it caught the eye of one of the curators that is out there, and I'll be in that thing. And I hope, you know, maybe so 4 years, maybe in another 6 years or so, I will have enough material to create a book. And in the meantime, I'm planning on creating some sort of a zine in the next year or two.
It brings up the question of visibility and presence, and you know, this sort of contradiction around like Canada, in the sense that like there are now stamps, for example, to recall and remember Angélique, you know, okay, the enslaved woman who, sure, burned down old Montreal. And, you know, in some ways, like the National Film Board of Canada has like really lionized Alanisa Bombsman's work. But this sort of always historicizes things, and it disconnects them from the present, you know. And I think like artists that are working now, well, of course, Alanis is still working, but I'm just thinking about like that importance of not, of connecting now and the past, you know, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We all have a voice. I mean, even if you're not an artist, you know, if even you work in an office building, I mean, you still carry the story. You still tell your neighbors, you tell your coworkers, you know, the things you experience in life, you know, that some people may not, it may never even occur to them to think about. Mm. You know, it may never even occur to them to think about residential school doesn't affect me. Yeah. You know, they may not talk about loss of land. You know, they may not talk about, you know, continuing, you know, encroachment of, you know, communities into reserve life. You know, it's a very complex story. But as artists, I think, you know, we have to speak out sometimes, and, you know, newspapers, you know, have to tell the story. And, you know, if we leave, you know, something, a record of what is going on, then I think we will have done our job, you know, to have this continue conversation.
Martin, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome very much there, Stefan. Thank you very much. Nyawa goa onigiwahi.
That was a conversation with Martin Loft, Indigenous photographer and printmaker, here on Free City Radio. Thank you so much to Martin for being on the program today. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. Free City Radio broadcasts weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., and on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we will be back next week.